Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I am joined by Anlu Kiver. Anlu, how are you doing?
Hello, Nicholas. I'm doing well, thank you. Nice to be back.
Good to have you back. We're also joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you? About to jet off to the United States.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Anlu. Yes, doing well, thank you. Hope both of you are doing well at the end of this week as well. Anlu can't get rid of me this week. Yesterday we did a webinar on the budget, so that went particularly well. So we have lots of numbers in our heads at this point in time. So if we just start talking about spreadsheets and debt to GDP, etc., please do excuse us.
I will keep that in mind. So we may talk about the budget indirectly today, but it's not in the list of topics today. The first thing we're going to start off by talking about is South Africa's manufacturing sector. Now, South Africa has had a lot of problems growing its manufacturing sector, even though this is a very politically popular one. We talk all the time. The ANC is very keen on industrializing the economy. You know, we had a few years ago the buzzword of the fourth industrial revolution, which was somewhat undercut by all of the load shedding. There's always this sort of talk about, you know, beneficiating minerals that we mine here within the country. Sort of this idea that the country can become this great manufacturing powerhouse with lots of, you know, unionized workers producing tons of goods that the rest of the world wants to buy. Well, reality is that the manufacturing sector in South Africa has been struggling for many years. And the reasons are pretty clear. There was an interesting little number of comments by Volkswagen Group Africa's chairperson, who on Thursday was speaking to a gathering and said that the extra costs being imposed on local manufacturers and longstanding legacy importers require a political discussion, because they complained that the costs imposed by having to operate a factory in South Africa are so great, all these extra costs from taxes, from regulation, and most of all from bad infrastructure, particularly ports and electricity problems, that locally manufactured cars are not able to properly compete. The chairperson said that Volkswagen, for example, is not exempted from load shedding in Nelson Mandela Bay Metro, where they build their cars. And there are also additional costs because of problems with transport, logistics, and port operations. She was speaking to a National Automobile Dealers Association event. She said, quote, "We now have two generators that cost 130 million rand because we need quite a bit of power. But every day I run those generators, it costs 1.6 million rand. That is a cost that is added to my business for us doing business in Nelson Mandela Bay. And no one will give me back that money that is added to the pricing of cars, because that money must come from somewhere." She said that Volkswagen only manufactures 27,000 Vivos a year in South Africa, as opposed to other cars in the segment being manufactured in other countries, where 300,000 to 400,000 produced in a year to benefit from economies of scale. She then said these vehicles are actually able to outcompete locally manufactured South African cars by coming into the domestic market at a more competitive price, simply because they are manufactured so much more cheaply that even when they're imported in, they still end up being cheaper when customers come to buy it. It's not just load shedding that causes these electricity problems. Nelson Mandela Bay, and indeed most metros in the country, suffer from large numbers of unplanned electricity outages, which, you know, are just as debilitating, in fact, sometimes even more debilitating than load shedding, because at least load shedding, you can usually plan for your outages. Unplanned blackouts can be even worse, because they just come upon you and can last for a very long time. The Nelson Mandela Bay Business Chamber has tracked 120 unplanned outages in the business areas of the city last year, each of which costs the country significant amounts. So, Chris, let me start with you. What's your take on these comments? The Volkswagen here is talking about the need for incentives to keep manufacturing goods in South Africa. If that means subsidies, I don't think that's the right way to go. We really can't afford subsidies, and subsidies usually don't fix the underlying problems. The underlying problems are the terrible policy decisions and the bad municipal governance. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so if you think about the industrial policy of a country, I'm hearing a bit of an echo, sorry. Is that fine now? Okay. I'm just thinking of industrial policy as a pyramid. So at the bottom, if your things like electricity supply, crime and security, labor relations, ease of doing business, if those aren't solid and don't perform well, then at the top, your things like subsidies, like master plans, like other forms of government protection and support, they're wasted, those forms of spending and funding. So it's effectively throwing money away because you're trying to account for the government governance failures while also having to invest in new production, new research and development, getting your goods to market, all that sort of thing. South Africa has a very strong consumer base and potential consumer market, and we have well-developed linkages with the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. So on the consumer side, there's demand, but then we don't make it easy for companies to get their goods to product, to manufacture them, to know over the long term that their investments will provide some sort of return on investment. Of course, return on investment is never guaranteed, but there should be at least some sort of base level or something along those lines. So South Africa has tried, I mean, before Minister Patel, during former Trade Minister Patel's time, now after he's left, we've tried these localization master plans where our form of industrial policy is either we announce tariffs on imports, so we try and protect local industry, or we try and identify some champions. So in automotive, in poultry, in some others where we provide subsidies, you know, basic support, because we want them to create jobs, etc. But when your government isn't fit for purpose and the enabling legislation isn't good, you pick winners, but you only protect them really from external competition. So they're not internationally competitive. And if you don't have sunsets to these tariffs, if you don't have limits on when these are removed and subsidies, those companies become dependent on those forms of protection. So they're not forced to be subject to market forces. And in time, you don't create globally competitive enterprises. So even though VW South Africa is, of course, part of VW internationally, they should theoretically, after so many years of support and subsidies, et cetera, be able and well-developed enough and strong enough in their local market that they don't need more forms of subsidies. If you talk about some other incentives, maybe you could talk about government lowering tariffs on the imports of EVs, for example, where South Africa has very high tariff rates on imported EVs, which is partly why the uptake has been slower in South Africa, not talking about just the inconsistent electricity supply as another reason. But there's a combo of things here that theoretically the government could do, but it is going to require, as we saw in the budget this week, a radical step change. It's not just doing things as you've been doing them up until now, because if you keep doing that, some companies will benefit. They'll be in the room when the master plans are designed. They benefit from subsidies. Others who want to enter the market, who want to compete, who want to really bring new products out, they just don't have the support and they can't deal with all the compliance. So what VW has raised, I think, is right. But for them and some other of the big automotive manufacturers in the room with DTIC and other entities, the impetus is on them as well to push for policies that might hurt them in the short term, but will open up the market to be more competitive, to remove legislation that's damaging, to give them that sort of space they need to develop to not be dependent on subsidies.
That's exactly right. You know, we should be focusing on making our industries more competitive generally. And, you know, sort of the way I've always thought about this, Andrew, and I'd like your thoughts on this. South Africa has this issue where, you know, if you're looking to manufacture something or mine something in the world, you can look at a country like, you know, the countries in Asia, Vietnam, China, India. You can look at Australia. You can look at DRC. Like, there are a lot of countries that provide similar things to South Africa, but they have different approaches to it. A country like DRC, if you want to go and mine or manufacture something or whatever, there's huge political instability. You have to pay lots of sort of like bribes and concessions and payouts to people in the area. But there's basically no rules once you get the sort of political backing to do what you want. So you're not regulated, whatever. You can produce everything super cheaply. A lot of Asia is also similar to that. Once you kind of get political approval for whatever you're working on, whether it's a factory or whatever, you can kind of do what you like. And so it's you know, there's instability, but there's it's also cheap. Or you can go to like Australia, or you can go to the EU, where there's tons and tons of rules, but there's stability, everything is regular, the quality of the sort of workforce and technology being employed is very high. South Africa kind of sits at this point where we've got the rules of Europe, but also the sort of unreliability of more dysfunctional countries in the world, which kind of means that we end up in a manufacturing situation where we have the worst of both worlds. Do you think that's an accurate assessment? What's your take on this story?
Yeah, I think it's very accurate. I think you've summarized it quite well. I think the government is focusing on the wrong things. They're trying to kind of get the governance of, say, some like Europe, but they're also trying to have the loopholes and keep the loopholes. I think government has to start paying attention where at least the manufacturers are starting to say, listen, it's not the biggest profit pool to make business in South Africa. That's a very big red flag. You have to pay attention to things like that. So yeah, you're completely right. I mean, I also think the Volkswagen are they're right in the sense that local manufacturers bear the cost of load shedding and making sure that they can still run their operations during load shedding and logistical constraints. All those things add to their cost and essentially their manufacturing cost. But they're also completely right in that they contribute to jobs in the local economy. So we constantly see government saying we want private sector money, we want their money, but we need them, or we want money to come into the country, but we also need them to contend with our issues. So Volkswagen in that sense is not alone. Ford, Toyota, Mercedes, BMW, these people have all, or these companies have all invested heavily in South Africa. And as business should be, they are drawn to, firstly, our competitive labor costs. But government needs to make sure that policies like a minimum wage and like race laws when we get to hiring don't actually hinder this, that it's not in the way of business being able to get advantage from that. And I'm obviously not promoting legislation that or promoting business taking advantage of labor. I'm simply saying that we need to enable free trade between individuals, and labor is one of the resources that people do trade. And secondly, business are drawn to our preferential access to the US market that we obviously enjoy under AGOA. So these sectors are automotive industry and manufacturing specifically, the automotive sector specifically is the, well, it's responsible for 6% of our GDP annually. 120,000 jobs, that's only direct jobs. That doesn't even include the jobs that's generated through the supply chain. Our vehicle exports to the US makes 10% of our exports to them. That's a lot. So if AGOA goes, it'll mean that there's, as Chris also mentioned, there's tariffs on these exports. And it's in a market that's already very price sensitive. So if you take, for example, Morocco, which is a competitor in that sense, if they still retain their AGOA benefits and they have lower production expenses, I mean, that will just, at the end of the day, diverts investment from us, from South Africa. So yes, I think they are completely right in the sense that we need incentives for businesses in South Africa. That does not translate to a subsidy. It means that we need policy change to, as Chris says, continue our competitive advantage in that sense.
I'm just drawing from some of the points you raised there, Anlu. There's this kind of often impression you get from government. And I think Gwede Mantashe, of all the ministers and government, is probably the most guilty of this, of sort of acting as though South Africa has some sort of monopoly on something. That the world, you often see this in kind of government pronouncements, the world will come to us. We don't have to incentivize them. You know, South Africa is just so ripe with opportunity and you know, business and resources and all these things that we simply need to open the door and business will come flooding in, begging to create wealth for us. And of course, it hasn't happened. At least, you know, for the last 15 years or so, the economy's been barely growing, less than 2% on average in that time. And it's exactly because, you know, we've got all these impediments. South Africa can be outcompeted by everyone. When you go to minerals, you can go, like I said, to Australia, you can go to the DRC. There's other countries around in Africa and around the world where you can get the same minerals you can get in South Africa for cheaper. Manufacturing, you can go to Asia, or you can go to Europe, or you can go to the US. This is exactly why we can't just pretend like we're some sort of island where everyone is begging to come, you know, do business with us, because that's just not the reality. Your final thoughts, Chris?
Just to add, we talk a big game about getting growth going in the country. The president, Minister Dean McPherson, they've talked about turning the country into a construction site. The sentiment is all well and good, but it doesn't help if the underlying fundamentals aren't in favor of real infrastructure, manufacturing, capital investments taking place. And that's where the rubber unfortunately hits the road, where it can't just be talk shops and workshops and investment summits, but where it's within your ambit, your choice as politicians and lawmakers to change these policies and legislation as well as regulations. So I think that's where it rests ultimately. It's by no means this ordained matter that capital must come to South Africa. We have to make it more attractive. In the current global context, we can make it very competitive. Some places are much more politically unstable and uncertain. We have a lot in our favor, but we tend to do very well at shooting ourselves in the foot.
Right. So let's actually talk a little bit about that. So on the surface, this may seem like a story that's kind of running counter to what we're saying. And that is that the European Union has announced that it is going to be delivering 94 billion rand package of investment in South Africa. This is what they say is going to be mainly for the transition to clean energy and for boosting vaccine manufacturing. This package is known as the Global Gateway Investment Package, and it was announced at the 8th SAEU Summit in Cape Town on Thursday. It's going to have 330 million euros in grants from the EU and its members, and loans from European financial institutions and South Africa's development banks to leverage a further 4.4 billion rand in investments. The investment package covers areas such as critical raw mineral processing, green hydrogen, renewable energy, transport, and digital infrastructure, local vaccine and pharmaceutical production, resources for skills development. Now, we actually did an episode on this a couple of weeks ago about how South Africa is, in this particular instance, I think very much benefiting from global affairs, with the US and the EU now entering into a trade conflict and, you know, just more broadly being in geopolitical conflict with each other. The EU is kind of going around and looking for friends who it can build trade relations with and kind of get on its side in global platforms. And this I think is exactly the entire reason behind this package investment here, or the claims of an investment here, is that they're basically trying to sort of butter us up. But there's still so much potential to mess this up. Firstly, you know, I think a lot of this stuff will take a long time to be realized. The money could always be misspent or not produce particular, you know, this is very much a kind of like political investment package. It's not, you know, it's going to achieve political objectives. It's not actually necessarily going to develop productive enterprises that really sort of produce wealth. And it's exactly the kind of thing that, you know, changes in politics could kind of yank out from us. So this is not the basis of what you should be trying to build your economy on. And if in, say, 5 years, trade relations improve between the US and Europe, maybe Europe won't be so interested in giving us this money. Or alternatively, maybe South Africa decides to sort of double down on its love for Russia, which is the one thing that the Europeans do care about. They don't really care about, you know, sort of BEE or corruption, all these things that they're not, you know, they're not particularly sensitive to those things. But, you know, if our foreign policy continues to flirt with Russia and Iran, it's very possible the Europeans might go, you know what, we have better options when we're trying to buy friends around the world. Chris, what do you make of this?
So I think a lot of what we should focus on when we're talking about getting new investments going is just the issue around what form those investments take. So in this case, are the investments in extractive projects where it's just about raw commodities, getting those out of the ground and shipping them elsewhere? or are they about building local manufacturing capacity, employment capacity, skills training, education opportunities, etc., etc.? I think there's a risk where we chase big investment numbers where things look impressive on the surface, but then in reality, it doesn't really translate into added value, added capital in a country like South Africa. So as much as we're going to be tempted to really follow the sort of path as South Africa, I think, because we're now feeling aggrieved and hurt by a country like the US. And now we think if any other country, quote unquote, wants to hold us close to give us these investments, it is in and of itself a good thing. And I think we need to be very careful about how exactly we pursue this. For a growing, supposed to be growing economy like South Africa's, we should be growing at what, above 5%. One of the necessary ingredients for that is cheap and abundant energy supply. We have coal deposits. We've got a coal-powered fleet. It doesn't always perform like it should, but that is to our benefit. It is there. We can invest in other forms of energy later down the line, but I don't think it's the most prudent economic growth point right now. If we want to lift quality of life, GDP per capita, etc. And there's the onus on entities like the EU as well to not incentivize and push countries in a direction where they just want investment in things that they think is to their benefit and not to that country's benefit. So I think we need to separate the emotion from the economic argument. Be careful what investments we go for and what don't we, and proceed accordingly.
Anlu, I see in the comments someone said, sounds like a rebound relationship. Someone's going to cry. What do you make of this?
Ooh, there I go. I thought I had to unmute myself. So you said when you started it that this might sound like it's counter to what we just discussed, but I think it's exactly what we just discussed. It's an example of government wanting to side on, say, green energy. It sounds good. It looks nice on a headline. It's massive investment, but then they keep these loopholes. So I just wanted to mention that. I think it actually fits in exactly with that narrative we just explained. But so the photo on that news article, I really want to just quickly stop there 1 second and just focus on it. It's like Cyril standing at the breakfast table, I assume, or lunch table with his hand and a glass of wine and big smile. And the moment I saw that, I had a little chuckle. Because he is completely disconnected from what South Africans really need. We do not need him to focus on green energy now. He goes to these lunches and he does his cheers, but then he goes to Joburg and he sees the conditions of Johannesburg and he's surprised. He's taken aback. And that proves exactly the point that he's disconnected. South Africans need him to focus on things. They're focusing on things that we can't afford now, and we need them to focus on things that can get our economy growing. As Chris said, cheap and abundant energy, whatever they're focusing on now is not going to help us grow. And then something that came out of this discussion that they had was that they know that the South Africa we want to protect the health of our people, as well as our autonomy and our local industries. Yes, we want to protect the health of our people, but if we don't start by focusing on the policies we really need changed, there won't be any people to protect the health for. There won't be any industries or local industries to protect the health for. So once more, they don't focus on the right things. I started by saying that the president's disconnected, but do you know who's really more disconnected than the president? European officials who think they know what South Africans want.
yes.
We need them to stop telling our government officials what they want to hear. We need them to stop telling them that you are the leading voice of the global South. We need them to start telling our officials, listen, don't look at what looks impressive, because yes, Chris was right. The numbers, they all look very impressive, but they counter to what the global trends actually suggest. Specifically for South Africa, we can see that tertiary sector is contributing more and more to our local economy. We are not at all in terms of education. Our science and maths numbers are looking horrible. So we're not prepared for that. So once again, focusing on the wrong things, and we need government to, yeah. We need Europeans to stop telling the government what they want to hear, and we need the government to focus on what we need.
One of the basic ideas in any responsible policymaking is that there are trade-offs. Whenever you do one thing, you're almost always going to get a negative consequence and usually a positive consequence as well. Investing, at least in the short term, in coal stuff, yeah, there's definite negative consequences to that. But you can also view it as a stepping stone. And countries like China, countries like India have very much recognized this. They're like, we need the coal power now, and then we can have nuclear, we can have wind, we can have solar, we can have all these things later once, you know, we've got our economies humming along nicely. And their economies are humming along nicely. What, India is going to grow like something like 7% this year. You know, China's been having economic problems of various types, but it's still going to grow at what, sort of 3-5% probably this year, something like that. This is exactly the kind of wrong way to go. And I think the Europeans are doing this more as a diplomatic maneuver rather than in a sort of genuine economic investment, in the sense that they, you know, believe that there's going to be some great return here. They just want us to, you know, back them up in trade disputes with the US, which is, it is essentially a kind of showy bribe. It's not a real economic partnership. Chris, your final thoughts?
Just the last point, if South Africa wants to move from the realm of in our foreign policy and geopolitical stance from moral politic to real politic, where we really get beneficial trade agreements, bilateral agreements, that sort of thing going, if we want this kind of financing, demand things like radical adjustments to the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism, which is going to impose higher tariffs on imports, demand that they reform on their side as well, which makes it easier for South Africans to export, to get goods into the EU, to build those lower down beneficial trading ties that don't rely on bureaucrats and just everyone else to make sure that they happen. And then just the last point on the energy supply. I mean, Eskom is a concentration risk for the economy. We're still massively over concentrated on Eskom. When it fails, the country as a whole fails. So renewable energy does help with some mitigating that risk, but the transmission grid isn't set up for that. So we must be careful that just because something fixes a little bit of an issue, as you said, Nicholas, there are trade-offs. So let's build a stronger, I think, distribution network with different sort of supply of energy where we can build it over the long term so it's sustainable. And we aren't just forced every, I don't know, 30, 50 years to go begging and looking for new foreign partners to come and build something for us, whether it's renewable, nuclear, whatever. South Africa needs to develop those capabilities and the funding for it.
Right. Okay, let's go on to our last stories. And I think I'm just going to kind of combine these together into the, you know, what you could call a kind of extortion epidemic. There was a story that I don't think we're going to get too much into the details of today, but it really fired me up, which was about informal settlements in Cape Town, where apparently there are gangs going around and literally installing lock boxes on communal taps and then charging people who are unemployed and living off of grants anything between 100 and 600 rand to access the water. Completely illegal, just total extortion, just sort of complete mafia stuff. And I think the fact that anyone thinks they can get away with this is just an indication that our police service is just not functioning correctly. A stat here is that in sort of the 5 years between 2019 and 2024, there were in the Western Cape alone 1,500 just under extortion cases opened with the police. So that's already a bit of an undercount, because certainly there were cases that were not even opened. That led to 683 arrests and only 36 convictions. So just keep that in mind as we talk about this next story, which is sort of related. And that is the fairly dramatic kidnapping of an Ethiopian businessman who was kidnapped in Johannesburg in public. Police did manage to track him down and rescue him after a firefight with a group of men. Five people were arrested. I believe one of the men was killed in the firefight. Turns out that two of the five men arrested were people who the US had sanctioned for for allegedly being part of the ISIS terror group. One of them was sanctioned last year. One of the men who was arrested was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury in July last year for allegedly being an ISIS facilitator and trainer, while one of the others was sanctioned in November of 2022 for being part of an ISIS cell in Durban. It's very clear that this kidnapping was an extortion racket to try and raise funds for the terror group. After the Hawks raided the building after the firefight, they confiscated two firearms, an AK-47 and a shotgun, as well as ammunition. So, Anlu, it really seems like, you know, extortion is kind of a problem that exists on almost all levels. You've got sort of low-level scumbags locking up communal taps. You've got construction mafias walking into sites and demanding that businesses hand over millions of rands worth of work to them for no other reason than because they demand it. And then you've even got terror cells looking to kidnap and extort people to get money out of them. What's your take on this?
Sorry, unmute myself again. the story about the extortion of the basic resources, though, definitely shocking. It was not unexpected, though. It's, as you said, there is definitely a growing extortion economy almost. and the problem is that this type of extortion catches on quickly. South Africa is now, excuse me one second. Between the budget and today, I've spoken too many words. South Africa now ranks as the sixth globally country in kidnap for ransom incidents, which is shocking. I think so. In 2023, between 2023 and 2022 and 23, there was more than 15,000 reported kidnappings. That is a lot. And then last year, that was 17,000. That's an 11% increase. And the thing is that these syndicates are becoming increasingly sophisticated. The biggest ransom paid so far was 150 million rand for one person's release. That is a lot of money to make from an extortion, from what we can call extortion. And there was another case specifically that I recall in something like 72 million. So it's not a lone standing incident. It's a recurring event of them only being willing to, they target rich, wealthy individuals or their family members. And there's been reports of these syndicates targeting families for months before they actually abduct them. The problem is that we already have a kind of not as good policing system. The Hawks have their issues. I know there's like serious organized crime investigation groups or crimes against the state. I'm not entirely sure who deals with this kind of thing, but it is a difficult crime for the police to act upon in a proactive way. It is unfortunately the case. Police agencies are generally on the back foot when it comes to this. And I suppose these syndicates have realized South Africa, it's easy to do and the gains are very high, which makes it attractive for that reason. And same is true for these informal settlements. I recall incidents of security being offered to fruit and veggie sellers, informal retailers and store owners, which is horrible because they already rely on such small margins, essentially, and they just start working out of nothing. For them to have to deal with being held ransom, essentially, because obviously we know you pay for security, but you technically just pay them not to rob you. So they're not really protecting you. They're just not robbing you. So yeah, very worrying. Exactly. And the community.
No, it's just a reminder of how these sort of, you know, this is exactly connected to our sort of point about manufacturing in the country and economic growth, is that this is another one of those extra costs that's just laid on all businesses. As you say, from the person selling, you know, Cook Sisters or oranges on the side of the road, all the way up to multi-billion rand investments in new buildings. You have these extra costs being imposed. You need to pay protection money. You need to bribe the construction mafia. You need to hire private security. And that's exactly why increasing security is a key component, actually, in increasing the potential for economic growth, which is the thing we desperately need in order to lift hundreds, millions of South Africans, hundreds, thousands, millions of South Africans out of poverty. All right. Chris had to jump off because of he's got a meeting to go to. But, Andy, thank you very much for being on the show today. And that's it for today. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we shall see you next week on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.